Please proceed, counsel.
May it please the court. Good morning. Jeff Morris for AK, a 13-year-old child at the time of these events when she was forcibly removed and continued to be detained from her mother, Ellen Keats, who we also represent here today. I would like to reserve a couple minutes of time for rebuttal, please. This case is about Arizona Child Protective Services social workers who took the most extreme actions under the circumstances where those actions violated the constitutional rights of mother and daughter under the First, Fourth, and 14th Amendments. In our brief, we have discussed four sets of circumstances that each independently give rise to a constitutional violation. Today, I plan to start discussing two of those. The first of which that I'll discuss is actually those set of facts that occurred last in time, and that is when CPS unlawfully and without justification continued the detention of the daughter from her mother, who is a fit parent, and continued to detain her for 4 months for an unjustifiable reason. The Supreme Court long ago established, under Stanley, Troxell, and Sandusky, that a state actor cannot keep a child from her fit parent. Troxell even stated that it is presumed that a fit parent acts in the best interest of her child.
So just to clarify, we're here on a motion to dismiss. Is that right? It was a motion to dismiss that was granted?
Yes, Your Honor.
So we're just looking at the allegations in the complaint. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so what you're telling us is from relating to specific allegations in the complaint and how those show that there's a cause of action.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Can you identify where in the complaint we find, what are the specific allegations that rise to the level of a violation of a 14th and 4th Amendment?
So under this set of facts, the continued detention, the facts in the complaint.
So just moving back in time, at the point where there was a dependency petition was submitted to the court, and the complaint doesn't reflect that there was a court order issued. I assume that the court issued an order, approved the petition. Anything after that time, is there any violation that could be raised after the court has ordered AK into the custody of CPS?
So there were two parts to your question, Honor, that I'd like to answer. First is whether there was a court order, and I believe that there was a order making AK a temporary ward of the court.
And when was that?
It's typically shortly after the dependency petition
was filed. So it was filed May 24th, and so it was sometime around May 24th it was issued. 24th. Okay.
And at that point, AK is still at Aurora. But as far as whether or not continued detention was lawful after that, Wallace is instructive here, as well as Sandusky. So if I could start with Sandusky.
I thought Wallace left it an open question.
Wallace did not leave it an open question, Your Honor. In that case where the child had been detained based on a sexual abuse allegation that a medical provider had said, and there was a petition filed, and they kept the children for 2.5 months, and then another medical provider said, that report is incorrect. There is, the records show that there was no sexual abuse. And at that point, the court said that the caseworker correctly immediately took action to return the child to her parent, or parents in that case. That is the type of situation that did not occur here. Here, when Aurora discharged the child as having only a low risk of suicide, the department had an opportunity to make a placement decision, and instead of returning her to her mother, they placed her, and she ended up going through 4 months of hell until she was finally removed or taken back to her mother.
So Wallace says that the city says it couldn't be held liable for any detention after their removal was approved by the juvenile court, and we leave it to the district court on remand to determine whether there's any violation. So isn't that what happened here? The juvenile court issued the dependency petition, and then it's an open question whether anything that happened after that point.
Well, I think there are really two parts there to the statement you just read from Wallace. One was that they recognized whether there was a constitutional violation, but on top of the constitutional violation in that case, there was a Monell claim against the city. And so the remand was about whether or not the city had a policy. That is not, there's not that wrinkle in this case. And I think Sandusky is instructive because it said there that the state cannot provide an alternative placement unless it can show that the parent cannot or will not provide a capable home.
And was there a court order in Sandusky?
I don't recall.
Yeah, I'm just not sure what the effect is of the court order. Can you talk about what happened before the court order and whether anything that happened before the court order supports the argument that the defendants here were liable under the 14th and 4th Amendment?
Yes, Your Honor. So the very first set of facts that give rise to a claim is that the caseworkers from CPS interfered with the companionship between mother and daughter at a time when daughter needed her mother the most.
And what specifically are you referring to? What allegation in the complaint?
The allegation in the complaint was that PCH, Phoenix Children's Hospital, had told mom that she can go home about 1 to 2 o'clock in the morning, and that they would reassess the child again that morning around 8. Mom went home, and when she called back at 8 and talked to Phoenix Children's, they told her that CPS had cut off all communication of every kind between mother and daughter. There was no justification for that kind of extensive and overbroad cutoff of communication. And we have that in Morrison, that this state actor cannot cut off all access unilaterally without justification. We also have in Wallace, when they talk about the scope of the intrusion, they say that when a child is going in for medical evaluations, that child is entitled as a constitutional right to the support of a parent unless there is some showing that that parent is causing harm to the child. And that is not in existence here. And that is what we have alleged in the complaint, that mother was the support for her daughter. The daughter needed her mother for support, and instead they cut off all communication when Phoenix Children's discharged her later that day, and CPS took the daughter to Aurora. At Aurora, they said, again, no contact whatsoever between mother and daughter.
Now, so can I just change the focus for just a minute here from Coily to the other participants?
That's where I was going.
Okay. The you have a group liability theory here under integral participation, and I want to know a little bit about your allegations in the complaint. There, have you adequately pled integral participation such that it can survive dismissal in this case?
And let's start with Gomez and Jenkins. As far as I can tell, there are no facts alleged in the complaint other than that they were working at CPS around the time that the violations occurred. No other facts. How can that possibly give rise to liability, individual liability, under an integral participation theory?
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'll start with your question first, since it's a little more specific, and then if I may go to Judge Smith. So for Jenkins and Gomez, we have alleged that they were participants in the decisions that occurred. As far as the timing of when that happens, that really occurs later in the case. And in that situation, it's a bit of a black box where we don't know who it is that's exactly making the decisions for the continued detention. We just know that there's a group of CPS caseworkers who are making those decisions and preventing daughter from returning home.
You could have taken the approach of having John Doe and Jane Doe defendants in that instance, but you've alleged individual liability for specific people. What's the allegation with respect to Gomez and Jenkins, and then secondarily with respect to Vanessa Lynch and Roundtree, who all they were, as I can understand it, were dispatchers who fielded phone calls?
Well, you're correct that for Gomez and Jenkins, there is not a statement in the complaint like we have for Lynch, Roundtree, and Vanessa. For those folks, they were part of the CPS team that was working that night when they cut off communication. We don't know who it was from CPS that made the statement to Phoenix Children's to cut off all communication. And they have acknowledged that those people, they were active in the case. But we have alleged enough on these facts in this posture to get to discovery to determine what it is that they have
run away from Gomez and Jenkins and focused instead on these other three. But I don't see how any of these five, under the integral participation theory, are they in the same position as all the police officers who were all participants in the challenge search and knew that the flash bomb was going to be used. They're not in the same position. They weren't watching. They're watching. You just don't know if they had any involvement. And with Gomez and Jenkins, you have zero allegations. And the case law, I think, requires involvement in some meaningful way. What's the meaningful way that these five individuals were involved so that they should go through the burden of an individual liability case?
Well, Your Honor, and I would like to answer your question and then reserve some time if I may.
Yeah, that's fine.
And that is for Gomez and Jenkins, we have alleged sufficiently to nudge them from the conceivable to the plausible that they were working on the case and making decisions when these constitutional violations occurred. And the nature of the constitutional violations is that they're decisions, unlike cases where it was throwing a flashbang and some physical action. These are decisions.
So I thought that you said that in paragraph 66 that Lynch and Roundtree collaborated in the issuance of the temporary custody notice, and Kim Pender was the supervisor for Coley and approved it.
That is correct. For the allegations concerning the initial interference by CPS, the initial contact was, as in the records, and we have alleged, it was between Vanessa, Roundtree, and Lynch. And then when the temporary order was issued, or the temporary custody notice, we have also alleged that those individuals also participated in the decision to issue a warrantless temporary custody
notice. And that's without any court intervention, is that correct? That's just done by CPS.
That is correct,
Your Honor. And then that's what put AK into the custody of Mr. Coley, who then transported her on a gurney to Aurora. That was how I read the complaint.
That is correct, Your Honor. Okay. And if I may reserve the remainder of my time.
We'll let you have additional time. We'll take you back to 3 minutes when we get there because we were asking questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Let's hear the government.
Good morning. May it please the court. James Bowen for the defendants' appellees. Just to take off from where counsel began his argument, this continuing dependency action, as the court pointed out, here's what happened. We went down, we removed and what we believe was an emergency, and the facts support an emergency situation, removed the child. Then under our statutory scheme, we must, within 72 hours of that, file the petition with the court, which was filed approximately May 25th.
Counsel, you're probably going to get to this, but I want you to know that it's important to me that you do get to the fact that whether Mr. Coley, I guess you are pronouncing his name did an adequate investigation into whether there really was an emergency. That seems, the whole thing seems to hang on that.
And, Your Honor, okay, then I'll get to that, but let me just finish this one thought. At my age, I forget quickly. But in any event, once the court got involved in this, the panel pointed out, once the court gets involved, we have 72 hours to file the petition. The court then, under Arizona statutory scheme, has between 7 to 5 days to hear, have this preliminary hearing. At that hearing, the court, one, advises the parents that they have a right to counsel, and counsel is appointed to them if they don't afford it. They have a right at the preliminary hearing process to give any relevant testimony. So the position is all these things they're saying that we withheld or may have withheld from the court, they could and did, I assume, present
we're
that.
We're here just on a motion to dismiss, correct? So, I mean, we're just looking at the allegations of the complaint and taking those allegations in the light most favorable to the complaint. Is that enough to make it plausible that there was a constitutional violation? I mean, we're not looking at other facts or we're not on summary judgment. So we need to stick with what supports your position that the court was right based solely on the allegations in the complaint.
Okay, and again, I guess the position of the state has been and continues to be, yes, at that point it was enough because at that point, frankly, the court, under Arizona statutory scheme, then makes the decisions on where the child should be placed, whether it has to make a specific finding, whether or not the continued dependency of the child out of placement or out of home. That court makes that decision, not CPS any longer. The court's making that decision based on what we tell them and what the parents and whatever else their attorneys might say.
Well, the complaint alleges that the court made this decision based on falsehoods that were told the court, or at least misleading statements that were told the court by Mr. Coyley.
Yeah. And not to get too far out of length, I'll address that issue. But let me first also answer the question as to why we got to this point. Here's what, and it's in the complaint. As you said, this is a motion to dismiss. We are stuck, and by the way, so is plaintiff stuck with the information that they pledge in their complaint. Right. Here's what we knew, or here's what Mr. Coyley knew at that point, that AK had a history for the last 4 to 6 months leading up to the point that we were asked to get involved of depression. She had gone to Christ Cares Clinic, which is a relatively low-cost or maybe free clinic, because of her depression. One of the folks noticed her in the lobby being crying and whatnot, so she, or that individual, asked, "What, you know, are you okay?" And she said, "No, I'm depressed." And after some discussion, they immediately said, "You need to go to an emergency room," which is at Children's Hospital. At Children's Hospital, doctors and evaluators there said, "Look, this girl is severely suicidal or severely depressed. She had suicidal ideations. That there was a report apparently coming from the Christ Care Clinic that she had actually attempted suicide the previous day." That's what the Children's Hospital and what the doctors say. CPS got involved because the hospital, Children's Hospital, said this young lady needs to be admitted. She needs to be in an inpatient mental health facility where she can be evaluated and observed. And the mother at that point said, "No, I don't believe you. She doesn't need any services. You're just trying to make money." And the hospital became extremely concerned that mom might come and remove the child from the hospital if there wasn't some way to prevent that. That's when CPS was called and they got involved. Now, they had that information. It was about 11 o'clock in the morning when Mr. Coyley actually interviewed Ms. Or AK. And at that point, she said, "Well, I'm not suicidal now. I've had depression, suicide ideation in the past, but I'm okay right now." The decision was made between Mr. Coyley and his supervisor. And after discussion with the people at the hospital there, we needed to move immediately. And so that's why we did the temporary.
Why did they need to move immediately?
But because the concern we have a child.
The risk?
The risk to the child was an imminent risk of serious bodily harm. She
risk
had,
from whom?
From herself. But the risk
she
also.
Was in the hospital. Okay. Why couldn't they go and get a warrant? Okay. Why didn't they have time to go and get a warrant?
Well, there'll be two reasons for that, Your Honor. First, Arizona does not have any type of pre-removal process in a situation like this. The way in Arizona, under our statutory scheme, that a CPS worker can remove a child with a court order, they have to go get a dependency, file a dependency, and then they can apply for what's called a pickup order. But Mr. Coyle and Mr. Pender, Ms. Pender did not have that process available to them, and still to this day do not, although Arizona is working on passed legislation starting next year, they will have a process like that. But at this time, they had nothing to go to. They had no way to get a warrant. The other reason they didn't have a reason at time to go get a warrant, they're afraid of the child, that she might harm herself, but they're afraid of the mother may lead to this because she's denying that the child has any...
Mother was gone at this time, wasn't she?
Well, yeah, we have been in a hospital in a situation when she's the mother of the child. She comes back at any moment. We don't know when she's going to come back. She can remove that child against medical wishes at any moment. And, you know, CPS's job, I think, is in this court in Baker, I believe it's Baker, where they point, you know, this poor job that the CPS-type workers have, they got to kind of balance, well, what's best for the family and what's best for the child. In this case, I think CPS, after talking to the medical professionals, getting this information, seeing that mom not only was indicating the child wasn't in need of any help,
so the hospital, I thought, according to the allegations in the complaint, the hospital told the mother that she could not have any contact with the child. And this was before any temporary custody notice or anything had issued. Am I reading that wrong?
Well, and this was something else that the counsel had brought up about the DCS, or Child Protective Services. It's changed names, so I apologize if I keep going back and forth. But Child Protective Services at the time. Again, plaintiff has to live by the complaint. What the complaint alleges, the only thing the complaint alleges relating to that was that Ms. Keats was told by somebody, apparently at Children's Health, that Coley had said she should not have any contact with AC as long as she's staying at Children's Hospital, which is a relatively short time, because what happened is that they made the decision to do temporary custody notice. They did that. Then the little girl was transmitted that very same day, and I don't know, can't tell from the complaint exactly, but a short time after that was transported to Aurora Hospital. There was no other allegation that anybody, Mr. Coyle or anybody at CPS, ever took any other measures. I heard him argue today that once she got to Aurora, that the state indicated that she wasn't to have any contact with her daughter. But that's not in the complaint. The complaint has that one allegation. The only other time they talk about some reference of restricting contact with the family was in their element. They have another element in here where they're claiming that we lied or gave false information to the court. And somewhere they've indicated, and I don't recall where in the amended complaint they said it, but they said something to the effect that, well, we told the court there was no restriction on mother, when in fact we know that Mr. Coyle, back on the 21st of May, told the hospital mom shouldn't have any more contact with her during the time she was there at that hospital.
I'm just looking at paragraph 83, which is when they make the second allegation that after the intake into ABHS, Mr. Coyle instructed that Ms. Keats was not allowed to contact AK. Is that... Do you question whether that refers to this subsequent period when she was at Aurora?
Hold on, let me look at... I apologize. When I went through all of this, my memory was paragraph 72 was the only reference where they said we restricted it. But yes, my position of the record, and again, the court can read that complaint as well as I can. I'm sorry, did you say 83?
Mm-hmm, yes, the last sentence there.
Again, I apologize to the court that that's what the interpretation of the court, but our position had been and it continues to be that when I looked through the complaint, the reference was what was going on at the hospital. This doesn't, I don't think, change that analysis, but even if it did, again, she's only at that hospital in an inpatient situation for, I think, about 5-7 days. I'm sorry, were there other questions that I haven't answered yet that I was going to? then if you don't have any other questions, I have 4 minutes and 19 seconds, and I'll let you guys.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it very much. All right, counsel, you have time for rebuttal.
Oh, just a couple things. Judge Ikuda, you identified that paragraph 83 clearly states that they cut off contact at Aurora. As was pointed out by you, Judge Bates, there was no risk of harm. She was in the hospital under suicide watch. Phoenix Children's doesn't have their kids on suicide watch committing suicide. That just doesn't happen. It's common sense. And the other thing is, they claim that mom could come pick her up, but she's following what is, albeit an unlawful order, to not go to the hospital. And yet they're going to penalize her and say that because she theoretically could, then there's an imminent risk. But recall that there are at least 3.5 hours after mom has been told, don't come to the hospital. She doesn't come to the hospital. And, Your Honors, if you have any questions?
I think not. We've both done a splendid job, of course, because the court has no more questions. So
we just request, Your Honors, that you reverse the district court's order in its entirety. Thank you.
Thank you both for your argument. The case just argued is submitted. We will now hear argument in the last case of the day, which is Sanchez versus Elizondo.